Welcome to this exclusive Brighteon.com interview. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon, and today we're joined by Dr. Andrew Huff, who is a whistleblower, as he's being called right now, but also an author of a really important book called The Truth About Wuhan. And he's a former top person at EcoHealth Alliance, so he knows all about SARS-CoV-2, he knows all about Wuhan, and he's got a lot to tell us today in this interview. Thank you for joining us, and thank you, Dr. Huff, for joining me today. It's an honor.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, absolutely. You are a very courageous whistleblower, and I think a lot of people have heard some of your interviews, but for any who haven't, please give us a quick overview of who you are, the work you did, and why you're going public now with these warnings.
Sure. So I'm not your typical scientist. I began my career in the military, actually. So I'm a product of 9/11. After 9/11 happens, I'm actually walking to college as that event occurs. And I decide to join the military with my friends in the Army as an infantryman. So I was combat deployed to Operation Enduring Freedom, Operation Iraqi Freedom. And at one point in my life, I thought I was going to be an economist or a finance guy. And war changed my perspective. I actually wanted to go back into science. So I have degrees in psychology, security technology is my master's with geographic information systems, so quantitative analytics. And my PhD, or like you mentioned, I'm an infectious disease epidemiologist. So during my PhD, though, I was a research fellow at the National Center for Food Protection Defense, which was a Department of Homeland Security Center of Excellence.
Okay, so that explains your knowledge about the food security issues that have been happening, some of the sabotage and things that are going on.
Oh, yeah, we can get into that. So yeah. I was actually handed a highly sensitive but not yet classified data set from the Department of Homeland Security as part of my doctoral thesis.
I see.
And so anyways, it contained all the data from the U.S. food system, and I was trying to figure out how to attack the system, where the vulnerabilities lied, to develop new analytical tools and processes and risk analytical tools for the Department of Homeland Security and other agencies.
Can I ask you before you go on?
Sure.
In that, was it a shocker to you to realize how vulnerable the system was and the lack of redundancy in the system? Or did you find that we have a lot of redundancy in food distribution and supply chains?
Well, over time, the food industry is under a lot of pressure to become more vertically integrated and have less redundancy to maximize profit. So oftentimes, what's good for the country is counter to what the business objectives are of large food corporations or even small companies. So the redundancy issue, we live in a just-in-time economy. That's the jargon term for it. So meaning the product that you buy at the grocery store was probably only created or made about 2 weeks before you purchase it.
Yes.
And they actually, they're so smart about this. If you're buying something like a granola bar, for example, they have a aging process which takes place before it gets to the store to make sure that it tastes best when you open it out of the box. I mean, they're that sophisticated about this stuff. And they were bringing me out to Washington, D.C. about 1 week per average per month. And during those times, I was being introduced to all the different leaders in national security, in food, and in health. And I was taught how to get the money, how to make the relationships, and how to become a powerhouse in this field. Well, through presenting my work that I was doing at the University of Minnesota at these meetings out in D.C., I was basically given the opportunity to work at any government agency that I wanted to, or even in corporate America. They had my advisors had the ability to help place me. And, you know, they asked me, where do you want to work? So I said, Sandia National Laboratories. I had befriended a couple of scientists there, and maybe you're not familiar with it, or the audience isn't, but Sandia National Laboratories is primarily a nuclear weapons laboratory. And they do have also a big biologics and public health aspect at that laboratory too. So that's the place I decided to go work. And I get top secret clearance working there, big, you know, gated facility, highly secure. And I get to see what's going on the other side of public health and bioterrorism, at least from a national security perspective. And I continue advising senior leaders in the government on various security risks. And we were developing computational models using supercomputers, artificial intelligence, Markov chain models, some really fancy stuff to predict and look at the consequences of terrorism, bioterrorism, public health response to pandemics. And I even evaluated some of the national pandemic preparedness plans, which becomes interesting later in life. So after there, I decided to leave Sandia National Laboratories because my work's getting increasingly classified. And as a scientist, that's sort of a death sentence. So if your work is getting increasingly classified, you can never leave that environment. You get stuck in the national laboratory system the rest of your career. I didn't want that to happen. So I started looking for new jobs, and I come across this place called EcoHealth Alliance. They had a really crunchy granola type mission. I'm trying to get away from national security at this point. And they had the stated mission of something to this effect: they're engaged in conservation activities to prevent emerging infectious diseases, meaning that by protecting and conserving nature of the environment, that you can reduce exposure or contact exposure between humans or animals where the diseases are and prevent outbreaks or disease transmission.
And this appealed to you because you were aware of like habitat destruction resulting in more emergent diseases and things like that?
Yes, and there's a lot of face validity to that. So basically, if you can conserve the environment and prevent people from going into places where there have been low human traffic, then it's pretty hard for a rare disease to emerge. Mm-hmm. And it's just
unless they build it.
Yeah, it's pretty simple logic. Unless they go in there with a bunch of foresters and, you know, into the jungle and cut down an area. If, you know, someone doesn't come in contact with the bat, then they can't ever get sick from it, right? Very simple. Well, the interesting thing is once I start working at EcoHealth Alliance after a period of time, I realize that that's not what's really going on. But backing up, I'm flown out to EcoHealth Alliance. I interview, crush the interview, goes well, and I'm offered a position there in short order. About a month after I interviewed there, I had already moved into New York City and I was beginning work there as a senior scientist. I crushed it. I brought in about $6 million in my first year. Most scientists don't make that over their entire career.
Bring it about funding?
Funding, yeah. Okay. I brought in $6 million of Department of Defense funding. Uh-huh. And I'm promoted to vice president as a consequence of that. So after I'm promoted to vice president, I get to see under the hood of what's going on at EcoHealth Alliance, and I'm actually sort of terrified by what I see across number of aspects of the company.
Just to interrupt, you've documented this whole thing in more detail in your book, right?
Oh yeah, so in the book I cover it in sufficient detail. One problem I had with the book was that the first draft was about 140,000 words, and I had an 80,000 word contract. Right. So I had to then just decide what to cut out. So I actually cut a lot of different things out of the book, but I actually cover this in high detail in the book.
Questions. I believe Skyhorse is your publisher, correct?
Yes.
The book is available now at booksellers like Amazon and others, correct?
Well, so yes.
Okay. Has it shipped yet?
Oh yeah, no, it's been out. So the book has been out since the first week of December.
Oh, okay.
And
what about the audio version?
The audio version's in the works. Okay. So I keep bugging Tony, like, when's it going to get done? I haven't been reading it myself. And if it doesn't get done fast enough, I might do it myself, but we're working on it.
It's, the audio book will be good, but also then, translations.
Well, that we've had a number of asks for translation. So European languages, German, and Japanese, actually. So a lot of people in Japan want to read the book.
Yeah.
And then we've had some requests for Chinese, actually, too, which I find interesting.
Yeah, that's I'm not surprised. Okay, so the book is, again, The Truth About Wuhan. And what's the subtitle again?
How I Uncovered the Biggest Lie in History.
The Biggest Lie in History, yeah, no kidding. Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt with all that, but I want to make sure people can get that.
Yeah.
Please continue with your summary. It's fascinating.
Yeah. So while working at EcoHealth Alliance, I'm promoted to vice president, and I start to see under the hood of what's going on. Well, so there's some minor financial fraud, which isn't so bad. I mean, you could call it double dipping is the term for it, or time card fraud. Things that as a manager sort of gets under your skin when you see it, because you have to like work these things out with the finance department or the other managers. Some of the other things that are more egregious, though, is that I come to the conclusion that my boss, Dr. Peter Daszak, is sort of an evil person.
We've all come to that conclusion, but you came to it first.
Well, it took me a while. Yeah. It took me about a year to get there, and I get there through a number of different pathways. But so
how do you pronounce his last name?
Daszak.
See, I keep saying Daszak for some reason, but everybody has a different. But it's Daszak.
Daszak is how he pronounced it, I believe.
All right.
So he's British born, but his dad was Ukrainian.
Okay, got it.
I think, as I recall. So as I'm promoted, I mean, the first thing is the big program at EcoHealth Alliance, besides my portfolio work, there's another program there called PREDICT. And PREDICT is funded by the United States Agency for International Development. And so with this PREDICT program, what they were doing is they're telling everyone is that we are going to predict and prevent the next pandemic. Well, that's a pretty lofty scientific thing to say. And I thought it was really cool, though. I mean, this is the thing I wanted to work on. So when I'm promoted, I asked to be added to this program. And, you know, there's probably a 5-inch manual for this program because it's been going on for a number of years. And when I say manual, I'm talking about peer-reviewed scientific papers, all the different gray literature related to the program, the government documents. I read all of it. And I get through it, and I'm like, there's no way that they're going to be able to predict pandemics with this. I'm like, this is pseudoscience. So they weren't collecting enough samples. So how the program actually worked was that they partnered with different countries around the globe, and then we would go collect disease samples. And we weren't collecting enough disease samples to be predictive. So the way that biosurveillance is supposed to work in these type of predictive models, it's complicated in a hurry, but one of the foundational pieces is that you need to be collecting data or samples on a routine, systematic basis. And for each country, let's say you don't only have enough money to collect 200 samples. Really. Or maybe 500 in some cases. And when I start to see this, I'm like, what the heck are we doing here? Yeah. So this is technically in science, they call it cross-sectional data. And then they were making all these claims that they're going to analyze the infectious disease agents for pandemic potential, which they do this in a quantitative manner. But I'm looking at this like, what are we doing? You know, so we're spending all this money on this program, and we're going out and collecting coronavirus and a few other different types of coronavirus around the planet, primarily looking for diseases in bats. I'm like, this doesn't make sense. So I call Peter out on the pseudoscience of this program at one point eventually, as our relationship begins to deteriorate. So this is one of the weird things. So here we are going around telling everyone around the globe that we're going to predict and prevent pandemics, but no, we're just sort of collecting coronavirus samples globally and then doing gain of function work. I'll come back to that too.
Yeah, and I want to also connect NIH funding, and I think EcoHealth went to the DOD, but it was turned down was it DARPA or the DOD?
Yeah.
There was a program that was turned down there, but wasn't it NIH or was it NIAID money?
So this is why I told the PREDICT story leading into this. So okay. Everyone believes that Dr. Anthony Fauci is the person responsible for the gain of function work. The truth of the matter is that the United States Agency for International Development began the gain of function work at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Wink, wink, CIA light. Yeah. So for people who are not familiar with USAID, it has a very humanitarian mission set, but it's also been used by the Central Intelligence Agency for 60 years to infiltrate other countries. If you go look up failed USAID CIA operations on the internet, like a Google search, you'll be amazed at what you find. Okay. This has been well documented. And I know this because of my national security background while I'm working there. So I start questioning internally what's going on. But so USAID actually provided the funding to establish the relationships between the scientists in the U.S. that are doing gain of function work and at the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
Now, can I interrupt?
Yeah.
Was this being done in order to work around the limitations on gain of function research in the United States?
Not at that point. So okay. The gain of function work actually begins in 2012 or 2013. And I've actually released documents on social media, and I've provided these to Congress to prove this. So I have the original unredacted gain of function proposal, understanding the risk of bat coronavirus emergence, that was submitted to NIH and funded by Dr. Anthony Fauci. I actually reviewed the proposal. That's why I have the original. And it's a trove of information. So the government actually released one, but it was heavily redacted. And I have the one that with the unredacted version, obviously.
But you haven't released the unredacted version.
Oh, I have.
Oh, you have?
Oh, yeah. No, I give it to everyone. You can actually go download it from my Twitter account. I put up a WeTransfer link, and you can actually have all my documents from EcoHealth Alliance. I've provided something like 4 gigabytes of documents to the public.
And I'm sure there were some unhappy people about that.
I'm sure. I don't really care, because the reality is this is all done under the guise of academic research, which is out in the open. And
supposed to be, yeah.
Correct. And the government has no right to redact any of this. And the FBI hasn't legally kicked in my door, so to speak. We can get to that. But I haven't been, you know, prosecuted for anything I've said or done. I haven't released any classified information. I know the rules very well. And I'm confident in acting on those. And I haven't been held to account for that. So,
okay. So then the USAID
yes.
is giving money and intellectual property to Wuhan?
Well, and this is where it becomes really interesting. So I like to ask people this question. So do you think the Chinese need $400,000 to conduct gain of function? Okay. Do you think they need $5 million?
No, the money's not the issue. They need samples. They need to know where to start.
There's more context here too. So before I work at EcoHealth Alliance, it's well known that the Wuhan Institute of Virology is likely the bioweapons laboratory for the Chinese. So think about this now that the EcoHealth Alliance is now doing a proposal funded by USAID to do gain of function work with the Chinese. It begins in 2012. And so if the Chinese don't need our money, you know, what do they need? They need the technology. Well, what's the United States getting out of this?
They're getting somebody else to do the dirty work of developing a bioweapon that can be transferred back to control over in the U.S.
Potentially, that's one of the things. The other thing is that we're collecting intelligence now on the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Yes.
The failed intelligence operation scenario.
Correct, because so if I like to explain this because I worked at one of these top secret laboratories. If foreign dignitaries or scientists showed up at our laboratory to take a look and see what's going on, what do you think happens? We take them on the special tour, you know, so we take what have them walk them in and we, you know, we show them things that aren't really important. We bug sweep everything and they're exactly. So that's the kind of thing that happens. So what do you think the Chinese do when Americans show up at this laboratory?
Exactly.
Yeah. So this was a boneheaded idea from the US government to begin with. So they're outsourcing the gain of function work to get around the domestic ban on policy. And the other thing they're doing is I think they're trying to collect intelligence on this laboratory. And the other, one of the other conclusions I come to in the book, this is also the largest intelligence failure in U.S. history, because one of the weird things that happens while I work at EcoHealth Alliance, there's three things related to it, actually. Well, we'll start with the best one, and then the other ones sound more interesting probably first. So the best one is, in 2015, Dr. Peter Daszak approaches me and asks me whether or not I used to work with the CIA. And I'm shocked when he does this based on my background and my experience. And I say, well, you know, panic. The CEO is asking me what I think of this. Peter, it never hurts to talk to them. There could be money in it. And then he says, you know, they're interested in the places we're working, the people we're talking to, the data we're collecting, and then mumbles something about sort of China, the China relationship that we have. Okay. And then over
in his defense, you look like you could have worked with the CIA. I mean, you know, you're smart, you're well-spoken, you have strategic thinking. I mean, you kind of fit.
I get accused of it all the time to this day.
You fit the mold of the CIA.
And I'm deep state. And I'm, what's the other thing I've been accused of? Oh, I'm controlled opposition.
But, you know, I'm on team humanity is kind of the way I describe it. But how do you define that, right? We want what you want, which is transparency. Let's let all the secrets out. Let's find out the real origins of this. Let's stop this kind of thing from happening again, if we can. But also let people have the truth about how to protect themselves.
Well, and then back to secrets. So there's the secret now. So here's my boss, Dr. Peter Daszak, telling me that he's working with the CIA. So a couple other interesting things happen related to that. So while working at EcoHealth Alliance, Dr. Daszak approaches me and he asked me to assist him with making an investment presentation, also known as an investment pitch deck, which is going to be presented to InQtel. Have you heard of InQtel?
That's the VC arm of the CIA.
Yeah, so the venture capital arm of the CIA. Yep. And so he works on his portion of the presentation. He wants me to put in the technology and the things that I'm working on at the end. So I read through his pitch deck and it's humanized mouse gain of function work to make countermeasures. Okay.
Wow. So bioweapons.
Well, sort of. I mean, like out in the open. I mean, so this is how this whole field has shifted around pandemic prevention, medical countermeasures. It's all out in the open now. Most of it is, I think. I guess I shouldn't say that. I don't know what's on the classified side because I've never seen it, but there might be something there. So here we are presenting this to InQtel, right? So another fun fact here is that our partner company, Metabiota, who's been in the news, so they had the contract through the Defense Threat Reduction Agency for the Ukrainian laboratories. Right. Okay, and those were invested into by Rosemont Seneca by Hunter Biden. So via Metabiota.
Okay, right.
Okay, so this you can't make this up. And it's not like, you know, tinfoil hat conspiracy stuff. I mean, you start to look here, you're like, what the heck is going on? And it's the biomedical industrial security base, essentially. And all these old, I should say, not old, but necessarily the uniparty ties in Washington, D.C. are strong financially into these organizations. And there's a lot of relationships for data sharing and other things between organizations like MetaBiota, EcoHealth Alliance, and the government, and a number of other, global nonprofit organizations like the Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation. And those names all come up in my documents too, believe it or not. Wow. So the other sort of spooky thing that happens while I work at EcoHealth Alliance is that I'm asked to prepare a collaborator report for an agency known as the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Agency, IARPA. IARPA reports to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. IARPA is like DARPA, just for intelligence. I have no clue why I'm asked to make this report. So I make the report. It's, you know, busy work task. I try to get off my desk. And I get off to Dr. Daszak, and I never hear anything. But here's the strange thing. So that happened while I was a scientist shortly after I was hired. Once I'm promoted to vice president, I have access to the financial records of the company. We're sitting in weekly finance meetings. We don't have any funding on the books from IARPA. And so I'm sitting here asking myself, and I didn't ask the question to Peter, but why am I submitting IARPA reports? I mean, this doesn't make sense. We don't have any funding from them. But I mean, I didn't care at the point. I was just trying to get my job done.
But probably EcoHealth did have funding from them, and this was a progress report.
It could have been.
Unbeknownst to you.
But it was related to my work. That was the strangest thing. So I was writing a progress report related to my work for something that I didn't know that we had funding to.
So at what point did it become obvious to you that this operation was kind of a front for funneling intellectual property and money into Wuhan, or that it was a failed intelligence operation? I mean, when did this become the aha moment?
Well, I had suspicions about it while I worked at EcoHealth Alliance, but the aha moment actually happens in 2020. So I quit working at EcoHealth Alliance in 2016, and I go on to be a professor and do other things. And in 2020, when the government comes out and basically they're not using the National Pandemic Preparedness Plan, which I had worked on before and seen and read from different agencies and the master plan, I'm asking people, what the heck is going on? Why isn't the government reacting appropriately, doing the things that we're supposed to be doing? Dr. Fauci coming out saying things that were not true. So this is, you know, him saying, well, this is not airborne transmissible. You know, do you remember that? Mm-hmm. And then it shifts to like, well, it might be. And I don't think that WHO has still acknowledged that to this day. But then, you know, you don't need masks. But when he first said that, it was sort of genuine, the fact that he was referring to N95s or better. That messaging was probably targeted at the public health community and doctors. Uh-huh. But that was a lie, because actually they needed N95 masks. And then he flips and like, well, you do need masks, and this whole mask back and thing forth, and we live through it. So I'm questioning everything at this point. And I go back and start looking at my documents from EcoHealth Alliance in 2020. And that's when I put it all together.
Wow.
And I'm like, this is what makes sense. Like, because what's the government lying about? I don't understand. Why are these people that I know that I've worked with in the government, people that I went to school with or people in my circle, you know, like, why are these people lying about this stuff? And the more that they lied, the more that I dug and asked the difficult questions about my own experience and what happened. And immediately when this disease breaks out at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, I knew that EcoHealth Alliance was doing the gain of function work there. It wasn't a question. I mean, we had discussed this work. I have the documents for it. And I'm telling everyone that it's a lab leak immediately. I'm like, this is not, whatever, how they're framing this as being coming out of a wet market doesn't make any sense.
Right.
This wasn't some dirty place, dirty third world market.
And it was clear there was a desperation to push the narrative that they were pushing. I mean, there was no counter opinion allowed in any of the dialogue.
No, and from a scientific standpoint, which I still find fascinating, is that the data that gets handed to us from the Chinese is given to the Western scientific community. And then they start publishing papers on it. And nobody questions the validity of the data that's handed to us by the Chinese. And there's a number of papers out there. I think they're all going to have to be retracted eventually.
Yeah.
And there's still scientists who are pointing to this. You know, sort of the people who are, I wouldn't say my opposition, but the people who say this is a natural origin, they have no clue what they're talking about, and they're completely naive, because there's no way that we would ever take data from the Chinese at face value and use it in science or in the government for analysis. They lie, cheat, and steal, and that's how they do business. They're not handing us the real data from this event. And in fact, the disease actually, this is what blows my mind, we have hard scientific evidence now that the disease actually emerged in late August or early September 2019.
Right.
Okay, so if you have all these scientists analyzing this data from the way that the events were portrayed to us, I mean, It's apples and oranges here. We're living on two different planets.
So do you think that eventually the truth of all of this is going to, I mean, I know it has already come out through your book and other books and other whistleblowers. And, you know, you've got even like Berenson and Dr. Malone and so many other people speaking out and telling the truth. The truth is obvious to anybody who digs, but the mainstream acknowledgement of all of this has not happened yet. Do you think they'll try to just cover this up forever?
Well, it's starting to happen. So I've been on Fox News twice, and they've been requesting that I come on more frequently. And so we'll see if that pushes. I mean, I think at least for this, because this, for whatever reason, has been labeled as conservative, right? This is conservative ideology for whatever, or libertarian ideology for whatever reason. Yeah. That's where they seem like they have the most tolerance for it. We're at a pivotal point in history for humanity right now, and it's very interesting. This narrative has pivoted, and I'm on the winning side of it.
Yeah, you are.
And I've been working my butt off to make sure that we win and we don't fail. And we just have to push this over the finish line. I think that the politics behind this is swaying in our favor. The more that the jabs themselves look like they're harming people, and this whole thing was fabricated. So here's an interesting fact. The jabs, the SARS-CoV-2 mRNA jabs were co-developed with the agent at the same time. So this is another thing I discuss in the book. So the genetic material from the PREDICT program goes into the gain of function work done at the Wuhan Institute of Virology with the University of North Carolina. It's Dr. Ralph Baric. Right. And Dr. Ralph Baric has all sorts of relationships with vaccine production for mRNA technology. And there's actually a US patent filed by Moderna in 2016, which matches a unique characteristic of the wild circulating virus. How does that happen?
Right.
2016, it was filed. Think about that. So we have all this evidence piling up, and I think as this starts to trickle out and get in the mainstream, it's going to be a tidal wave. You know,
But there aren't very many people in your position who are willing to blow the whistle and state this publicly. Now, I mean, I interview whistleblowers like Dr. David Lewis of the EPA, blew the whistle on biosludge, they shut him down, pulled all his funding. They came to his house. They threatened him. I know you've been threatened too, but what motivated you to go public with this? And because, I mean, you've burned a lot of bridges, frankly, in your old world, all those connections. You're not going to get a top secret clearance ever again. You're not going to have a government job probably ever again. You burned those bridges on purpose. Why?
Well, I had no desire to ever go back. I had already made the conscious decision before the pandemic happened to leave all that. And the reason why I left it was because of all the corruption and BS that I had experienced. I was really good at getting the funding, the money to do the work. And when I realized that science was more of a directed research by the federal government and applied in the sense that they want you to solve a problem that they think is important, and they often want you to solve it a certain way, it took away my excitement and joy from being a scientist.
Yes.
So you ask yourself, what are you doing? Well, okay, I'm a talking head to get money to do research, and I train students and you teach or do these things. And if you really want to be a scientist, it's not the way to do it. So I've started finding other ways, other things to get involved with. And the fact of the matter is our liberty is at stake. Our country's at stake. I'm a patriot. I have morals. I mean, I have integrity. I have all these qualities that many of our leaders don't have now. Yeah. And I'm going to do the right thing, and I don't care what the cost is.
Well, okay. Simple enough. I mean, that's why I'm here too. That's why we're all in this space right now, because, you know, morality, ethics, being pro-human is more important than whatever money or power, you know, an entity, a government, a CIA, or anybody could offer any of us. So I'm glad to hear you say that. Now, we only have a few minutes left. I'd like to ask you about food sabotage.
Sure. Because,
of course, it's been documented over 100 food facilities in the continental United States have been, burned, and arson, and other things have happened. And there seems to be a pattern, because it's happening more now than ever before. And you recently did an interview. I forgot who that was with, but you were talking about that.
Could have been Sean Morgan or Emerald Robinson.
I think it was with Emerald.
Yeah.
About that. And you spoke about that. I think we actually did a story about your interview with her. Can you just briefly give us your take on what's going on with the food sabotage?
Yeah. So I think it's a new type of fifth generation hybrid warfare. I think it's the intent of the attacker is to destabilize the economy and create uncertainty and create maybe some fear along with that. So not traditional terrorism where they're trying to accomplish a political objective, but I think this is one slice of a bigger picture of something that's going on. So I don't know if it's like the globalist types. They would certainly have incentive to do it, World Economic Foundation types, because everything they're if you listen to what these people are saying, it comes true. You know, they've been talking about food shortages and all these other things.
And now they're talking about major cybersecurity events coming soon.
Well,
by the way,
in the cyber, I think actually the main, the food attacks were cybersecurity events. So they hack a system that has a logical controller or something, and then they cause it to overheat. You know, if some part in it's the like process
sucks that part too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think some of these attacks were that. I think some were actually probably just lit with a match because it's really easy and low tech.
Yeah, exactly.
You just have a guy with a can of gasoline show up and you can ignite one of these places and there's no fire department.
You indicated in that interview, I believe, that it seemed like the pattern of this corresponded to the federal food security databases that exist.
Well, I was going to get there. So during the harassment that I experienced from the federal government, a couple of interesting things happened. But I do have two hard drives that go missing containing all these national security data that I had worked on during my dissertation and that I actually continue to do research, modeling simulations of attacks on the supply throughout my career. So I had been working on this my whole life, was something I was interested in. And there is a top secret version of this data, these data that exist, but because I created it as a scientist, it wasn't classified. So I'm still entitled to have it. Well, these go missing from my house. And I actually reported it to the top levels of the FDA, the USDA, FBI, and Department of Homeland Security. I haven't received a response. And I've contacted them a couple different times.
So based on what you believe about what's happening with this, do you think that food sabotage is going to continue?
Well, I think so. And I don't see it ending anytime soon until they find out who's doing this and why they're doing it.
Were you aware that Union Pacific Railroad frequently fails to deliver many train loads of grain to cattle and chicken operations in places like California? And the only way the grain gets delivered is if the company, in this case, Foster Farms, begs the federal government, I forgot which Department of Transportation, to order Union Pacific to deliver the grain so the cattle don't starve. Do you know that's going on?
No, I didn't, but I don't find that surprising either, especially in California where you have transportation bottlenecks between what you call the breadbasket of the U.S. and California, because the geography is unique. And so in food systems, it's oftentimes difficult to get food in and out of California for this reason. So I don't find that surprising.
What are your thoughts on the fact that, in the current environment of globalization, we have very efficient, low-cost international transportation on shipping containers? So in many cases, there are food raw materials that are harvested even in the United States, shipped overseas for processing and manufacturing, including pork, for example, and then shipped back in order to take advantage of the cheap labor and so on overseas, or the lack of labor regulations, what have you. But isn't that a crazy vulnerability of the supply chain that people aren't really aware of?
Absolutely, it is. And I became aware of that first with the apples. So apples are picked in the United States, same thing. They're shipped overseas to China in big ships, container ships, and then they press and process the juice and they send the concentrate back to the U.S.
Right.
And then they rehydrate it and make other products. It's just insane from two different perspectives. The externalities here on the environment, for a lot of the people who claim that, people claiming that they're concerned about environmental issues. Well, the externalities of these type of activities are ridiculous. And the biggest concern right now happening in my perspective with the two big areas are one of these attacks that are going to create instability in the system and bankrupt a lot of local communities. The other issue here is that since the late 2000s, the Chinese government has been increasingly buying up food and agricultural production in the United States. I think 80% of meat production actually is owned by the Chinese through investment. So not direct ownership per se, but sometimes they might invest into a big company, okay? And then with that investment into that company, then that company then will buy the American food processor or the farm. So what we're seeing is a large, basically hostile takeover of American food production by the Chinese. And we actually raised this issue at a national security meeting. Me and my mentor, his name's Colonel John Hoffman. And we were stomping up and down saying we need to put some policy in place, or go talk to the Capitol Hill, or, you know, get a conversation going around here to prevent this, because that's a national security risk. You don't want your manufacturing, your food, your water owned by the Chinese. You just don't.
Do you have an opinion on who blew up the Nord Stream pipeline?
I believe it was the United Kingdom, probably with another country, NATO country, probably.
Okay.
Could have been Ukraine. I don't know about that, but I don't know if you saw the leak from the Russians of the foreign, well, I forget what it was, but like an ambassador or somebody in the United Kingdom texted, "It's done," immediately after. Yeah. And so I really think it was the UK.
And this gets to deindustrialization and national security. I know we're almost out of time, but are you aware that BASF, BASF is essentially shutting down operations in Germany, moving and setting up new ops in China? They just wrote off $7.9 billion of an investment in Russia, which was a joint venture partnership with Gazprom. So BASF just wrote off $8 billion, shutting down. They produce 45,000 chemicals that are used, you know, through everything from pharmaceuticals, textiles, food, and also ammonia, urea, nitrogen-based fertilizers. They're shutting down in Germany. I mean, even in the U.S., the national security implications of not having a European supply chain for industrial chemicals that are used in everything, you know, aircraft, paint, you name it. Shouldn't that be, I know that maybe this is not your area of focus, but shouldn't that be a major national security issue for the United States?
Well, I say national security is one of my areas of expertise. So, yes, it's interesting. So it depends how you look at the problem. So if you are an imperialistic United States or imperialistic China, it makes perfect sense, because you create more dependency. Europe has then more dependency right. on the United States True. Or in China. If you don't have an imperialistic attitude, then it doesn't make any sense at all if you want to have partners and strategic allies. The other thing, too, is that having geographic diversity in chemical production is a good thing, because chemical facilities are highly concentrated facilities. And what happens, like here in the United States, for example, you have a hurricane that hits the port of Houston, it'll knock out a lot of petrochemical for a period of time. Right. And then you see gas prices go up and people are like, why is gas increasing? Yeah. So having redundant systems and having them geographically separated or distant is often a good thing just for people in general.
But in this case, these facilities, the base of facilities, are moving from Germany, a U.S. ally, into China, a country with whom we are likely to be in economic conflict soon over Taiwan, right? So what if China just says one day, oh, we're going to nationalize all the base of facilities in China, no exports?
Well, and that's probably essentially what they're doing, right? Because anybody who goes into China doing business, that's essentially what happens.
Or exactly.
Within some amount of time. Maybe it's not right away, but they're accepting that, and they're probably getting paid handsomely for it. It's like, who's getting paid from this? So their executives are probably making a killing. Everyone, you know, middle management's probably making a killing. So everyone in the company probably wants to do this. They probably don't care. I don't know enough about it to say whether or not there's some strategic advantage for the company relocating to China. Say, for example, maybe a lot of their precursors come from Chinese facilities already.
Well, a lot of their customers are Chinese. China is the biggest buyer of chemicals from BASF in order to be part of their processes, you know, their manufacturing.
Well, I wonder what the Germans think about this.
That's
the more interesting thing here. I mean, are they happy? So the other thing, interesting thing that's related to this, which is happening in Europe, is the shutting down of farms and production and commercial carbon emitting things,
and metal smelting operations.
Yeah, well. and it's they're hollowing out their ability to do anything. Do anything in terms from a national security perspective. So, right. You know, if they don't have their own food production, and they're clamping that down, they don't have their own chemical or manufacturing base. You know, what are they going to have left? And I'm sure that this kind of at least the petrochemical sector moving to China could also be related to this. So there's a lot of talk, you know, Saudi Arabia was grumbling about the petrodollar, you know, so if they make right. it the petro yen, it would actually be a huge strategic advantage to move BASF to China.
Yep, that's all happening. Obviously, you know a lot. I've really enjoyed talking with you here, and there's a lot more to cover. Hopefully we can do this again sometime soon. But I want to mention your book again, The Truth About Wuhan. And do you have a website or social media channels you want to share with the audience?
Absolutely. So I was recently maybe shadow banned again on Twitter. I don't know. But but I'm on Twitter, A-G-H-U-F-F, A-G Huff. And I have a website, andrewhuff.com. And the book's available on Simon & Schuster, Amazon, or any big box store you can think of.
Okay. Well, fantastic. Well, thank you, Dr. Huff. It's been a real pleasure. I really enjoy the intellectual stimulation of interviewing high IQ people and people who are informed. And you're definitely one of them. So I wish you the best. And folks, thank you for watching, and feel free to share this interview. You can repost this on your own channels and other platforms as well. Of course, I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon.com, and we've been speaking with Dr. Andrew Huff. Again, andrewhuff.com, is that correct?
That's correct.
And the book is The Truth About Wuhan, which is spelled W-U-H-A-N. Thank you for watching today. God bless you all. Take care.